Our text this morning is taken from Acts chapter 23. We'll read from verse 12 through verse 35. Acts chapter 23, beginning in verse 12. When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. They went to the chief priest and the elders and said, "We have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now therefore, you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you, as though you were going to determine his case more exactly. And we are ready to kill him before he comes near." Now the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, so he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take the young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him." So he took him and brought him to the tribune and said, "Paul, the prisoner, called me and asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something to say to you." The tribune took him by the hand and, going aside, asked him privately, "What is it that you have to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow," as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. "But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for your consent." So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, "Tell no one that you have informed me of these things." Then he called two of the centurions and said, "Get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen, and go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. Also, provide mounts for Paul to ride and to bring him safely to Felix, the governor." And he wrote a letter to this effect: "Claudius Lysias, to the excellency, to his excellency, the governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him. Having learned that he was a Roman citizen and desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. And when it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against this man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him." So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to the Antipatris. And the next day they returned to the barracks, leading the horsemen on with him. And when they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. And when he had said to him, "From Cilicia," he said, "I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive." And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's Praetorium. We're learning more about Paul's going. Remember, as we look at this passage, I want to think about how we apply the Bible. We always want to read the scriptures and find how do we apply this to ourselves. And we need to understand it within its context, within its historical context, and within what we would call the Christian context. See, some could take this passage and say, look at this. There's a threat against Paul. But what does God do? God protects him and saves him. And there may be a text to say, you know what? You're going to enter trials in this world. People are going to accuse you. And guess what? Put your trust in God and he will deliver you. That would be a misappropriation of this text. Because yes, as I've said, mentioned, like, does God protect Paul from this plot? Yes. Did Paul live to a ripe old age? What about James? What about all the saints? See, we can't take these passages and just apply one context out of its entire context of their life of Scripture. But there is something here for us. Because there is, as we've seen through these passages, if you haven't been with us, we've been through a week, right? We have shown how when there's a sense in which, as Paul has gone to Jerusalem, there's a sense in which Luke clearly shows us that there's a sense in which Paul is following his Lord. And we see elements of that here as well. Remember, Paul says he was willing to, as he was warned of what was going to happen in Jerusalem, I'm willing to even go there and to die in Jerusalem. He's not going to die. And let's look at that. Because you and I, we don't know when we're going to die. Or if something happens to us, whether we're going to escape it, right? We do not know that. At least you may think you know. I don't know. But we need to look at verse 12, following verse 11. Because in verse 11, Paul gets divine revelation. The following night, the Lord stood by him and said, "Take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must, it is necessary, to testify also in Rome." Paul knows he's going to Rome. He knows he's going there because the Lord said he's going there. And he told him, take courage. Remember, in this section, Paul, there have been a couple of riots. There was a riot, there was first a riot in the temple when he got there. Then when he spoke to the people, there was another riot. Then he went to the council of the Sanhedrin, there was another riot. And the tribune has saved him. This reminds us of something earlier in Paul's journey. In Acts chapter 18, verses 9 through 11, we read this. "And the Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, 'Do not be afraid, but go on speaking and do not be silent, for I am with you. And no one will attack you to harm you, for I have many in the city who are my people.' And he stayed a year and 6 months teaching the word among them." Notice, I have a purpose for you. And that's what Paul's purpose. Paul had a divine commission. And of course, later on in that chapter, we have there was an issue of people coming against him, and verses 12 through 17. But Galileo paid no attention to the Jews. Well, here now in Jerusalem, very similar. The Lord Jesus stands before Paul and says, "Take courage. I will be with you, and you're going to go to Rome." But then, in our passage, our first point is there's a plot hatched. Let's look at verse 12. This plot hatched against Paul. The Jews formed, it says here, the Jews made a plot. The word made there, they formed a plot. And it says here, and bound themselves by an oath. That sounds, have you ever bound yourself by an oath? Yeah, you probably have. Not all of you. Everyone who got married bound themselves by an oath or a vow. It's a very similar oath and vow. But these Jews, literally what they're saying is, they place themselves under a curse. That's the type of oath. In fact, this verb that's talking about what they did, guess what the English transliteration is of it? They brought themselves under an anathema. They basically said, "May God curse me if I don't kill Paul before I eat and drink." You've heard the term. I mean, now we have a weird world with culture and all these, media things, but these are haters. Yeah. Let the haters hate. These are haters who hate. And they hate. One thing I want to say. Who are they really hating? I remember when I first read this. I don't know about you, but I read this. These guys said, "May the Lord curse us if we eat or drink before we kill Paul." You read that, right? Now, we know the story. Did they kill Paul? Did they eat and drink? See? Their hatred, their sense, if God was going to really fulfill the curse, they'd be dead. Like take a fruit. They're calling a curse upon themselves. Anyway, they're haters. Now, it's interesting because we're not sure who this group is and who they are. But they go to the leaders. Think about this. They go to the chief priest and the elders. Now, commentators say, remember, Paul was just at the council, remember? And they had these, and he mentioned that on here because of the hope. I believe in the hope and the resurrection, which the Pharisees believed in and the Sadducees didn't. And that's what got him out. Very strategic, we saw last week. Well, so what they're saying is, I want you guys to bring him here again under pretext of doing some more examination. But the people that he addresses here, Luke says it was the elders and the chief priests. Those were probably the Sadducees. Now, in the council, the Pharisees would be there, but he's speaking to the Sadducees. Because remember that it was the Pharisees who stuck up for him. And they said, "We find nothing wrong with this man." So this is a hatch. But they're going to the leaders, and these people aren't the leaders, but you know why they listen to them? It's because they are also haters. They're the same haters. They have something in common. Hatred of Paul. Now, who do they really hate? They hated Jesus. You have to understand this. This is very, very important. Paul would know this, wouldn't he? When Saul of Tarsus He was a hater, wasn't he? With Poopy in prison and went to Damascus. He was a hater. He was hated. And when he was stuck on the road, I mean, he was a hated Christians, right? But on the road, what did Jesus ask him? He doesn't say to him, "Why do you hate Christians?" He says, "Why do you hate me?" Christians need to understand that the people who hate us, see, we take it personal. That seems like, of course we take it personal. But we need to learn. It's not personal. At least not against us. You see, if someone, by the way, if someone tries, if someone goes out there and picks a fight with me, I'm going to run because there's no way I can defend myself. I get slaughtered. I'm going to date myself, but back many, many years ago, someone picks a fight with Mike Tyson, they're an idiot. What about if someone picks a fight with the Lord of heaven and earth? See, that's what haters, that's who they're hating. So this is why Luke is very clear to show us the parallel. That Jesus, as we said, Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me. That's what's happening to Paul. It's not so much his cross and his suffering, but there's a sense in which he's sharing because he's connected. Just as Paul continued to go against those who were Christians because he was trying to wipe out Christ because of the word that was being preached. Remember, even when the disciples early on in Jerusalem, they said, you know, you can be around. We don't hate you, but don't say that word anymore. It's that word that we don't like. If you remember, even in the temple, when Paul, after was being in the barracks, and Paul went again and said, I want to talk to the people. And he told them things. He was recounting things. They listened intently until he said a word. What? When Jesus said, I will send you to the Gentiles. Then they didn't like it. Because of the word. So, we see this plot. On pretext, call him and say that you want to determine the case more exactly, and we're going to be ready to ambush him. So we have the plot hatched, the plot of haters. But then, providentially, the plot is uncovered and reported, our second point. It's interesting, we don't know much about Paul's sister and such. We don't know much about his family, but we learn in verse 16, he had a sister and his sister had a son. So Paul's nephew heard of the ambush. So he went to the barracks to see Paul. Remember, Paul's a Roman citizen. There are certain rights. That's important. Remember, he's a Roman citizen. He has certain rights and responsibilities, or certain rights. I always say rights and responsibilities, just my thing, because everyone in the world, I walk and you talk about their rights. And I always tell people, you know what, if you have rights, that means you also have responsibilities. No one wants to talk about the responsibilities. They always want to talk about their rights. But here, Paul has rights as a Roman citizen. And notice, he calls the centurions. He calls one of the centurions. It's interesting because there's a sense in which, though Paul's a prisoner and the centurion to guard over him, socially, Paul is his superior. The centurion probably was not a Roman citizen. That's probably why he's able to call him. We're not sure exactly, but so he calls the centurion, and he says, take this young man to the tribune because he has some information for him. And so he does it. He obediently does it. Imagine someone in San Quentin telling the guard to do something. Well, and he says to the tribune, Paul the prisoner called me and asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something to tell you. Here, see, the plot is overheard, and then it's communicated to Paul. Then from Paul it's going to be communicated to the tribune. And notice that the tribune we see some wisdom going on here. He actually goes privately. to find out. And he's told. And he believes it. Of course, why wouldn't he believe it? Remember, the riots. He's had to rescue Paul at least 2 times from being killed by these people. That's why he's in the barracks. So, he has this issue. They're ready. They're going to fool you. And what will happen to him? He would allow a Roman citizen to be murdered. That ain't good. Not for the tribune. And he's told. You notice, by the way, he gives them the complete things. He says there are more than 40 of their men lying in ambush who have put themselves, again, anathema, who put themselves under this curse to kill Paul before they eat or drink. I'm thinking back what happened the fourth day. Hunger strike. Anyway. But look at, so the plot has been hatched. The plot has been discovered and reported. Now the plot is averted, or averted, I'm not sure. The plot does not come to fruition. Look at the reaction of the tribune. He called 2 centurions. Get ready 200 soldiers. Don't miss that. How many men have put themselves under curse to kill Paul? 40. Seemed like overkill to me. Doesn't seem like overkill. Of course, he's making sure. That's what he's doing here. He says, take 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen, cavalry, and 200 spearmen. By that way, that 200 spearmen could be 200 archers, or some have, it's a rare word, it could mean 200 local police. I don't know. But we're talking 470 to guard one man. 470 to guard one man. And go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. Third hour of the night, 9 or 10 p.m. Under cover of darkness. You've heard of getting out of Dodge? Well, he's getting Paul out of Jerusalem. Jerusalem's not a safe place for him. Kind of reminds me, remember when Paul was let down through the window, through the wall? Yeah. Another protection. And send him and provide, by the way, Paul's gonna have a mount as well. Because this is going to be a quick trip. Paul's not going to be like in chains or something as a prisoner. Again, he's a Roman citizen. This is to protect Paul. This tribune, other than his interrogating him, because he didn't know he was a Roman citizen, which, as I said earlier, was somewhat Paul's fault because Paul could have told him before he did it, I'm a Roman citizen. Paul didn't tell him that. He did that for a reason. Previous sermon. But this tribune has done an excellent job of protecting Paul. And he's continued to do that. And then he writes a letter to Felix, the governor, to give him a summary account. Though he doesn't have every detail, not how many times, but he gives a pretty accurate account. Now, people will say, but he didn't say that he tried to, because he tried to, interrogate him, with the whips. Well, yeah, would you say that? Again, as I said, because this is a summary of what he said, and that's fine. Luke even says to us, that it is a the letter is a governor I wrote a letter to the this effect. Okay, that's why we don't have the letter in quotation marks. I think that's what the letter said. But notice what Luke has here. As I said, it's a summary, but this is the important element. Verse 29. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. Remind you of anybody? Pilate? In his statement about Jesus? Again, this is another echo of what happened to Paul's Lord. It's an echo. It reminds me what? Of the statement that was raised in the book of Acts, and we've learned that, you know, the song that was quoted, "Why do the nations rage?" As I said, the nations included Israel. Because that's who raged. And in the psalm, who wrote that psalm, by the way? Why did the nation rage? David. Who did he have in mind primarily when he says, why did the nation rage? Saul. King Saul. But it's fulfilled ultimately in raging against the anointed, whom David prefigured, Jesus Christ, and those who are in Christ, such as Paul, and all Christians. And so he sends them. He's safely given over. By the way, they get to a certain point, and the only people that continue on with him is the cavalry, because they're at least safely out. And they go to Caesarea. The governor receives a letter. We're going to learn a little bit about Felix as we go on. Felix, historically, has not been what you would call a great governor. He's not a guy you would want to elect if we were going to elect someone. But at least here, he seems to do everything right. The other thing I want to, before we try to now apply this to ourselves, I do want to make a textual note, because people may say that in the letter, he says, in verse 30, "And when I disclosed to me that there was a plot against the man, I sent him at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him." Notice, we have no account of him saying that to the accusers. And what is happening here is, it's common within this culture, is you would write something and include in there things that would have happened not when you wrote them, but by the time the person is reading it. There are a couple places in the Bible where that happens. Because again, they don't have the internet. Send an email out, okay, and you get it in an instant. Here, this is what he's doing. Just, if people have a question, what's he doing? You didn't, well, he is. He sent the letter, and then he probably communicated to the Jews as well. Same city. Just a point. Now, what's going on here for us? Remember, what I've tried to show you is that there is a commonality with all Christians with Paul in one sense. This goes back to what Jesus says: if you follow me, you're going to take your cross, because his life was the life of the cross, a life of suffering. That's what he means. And the cross is the epitome of that suffering. And he says, if the world hates me, they're going to hate you. And we see that through Acts. We see it through the early apostles, and we see it through Paul's life. In that way, we are in the same world as Paul the apostle. And we may be more cleaned up. We may have a lot of advances. There are some places where there, again, we know in the Bible, there are some places where churches do well, and they go down. See, we think that if we send the word out and such, we're gonna have friends and influence people. That may happen, but that animosity between this fallen world and Christ will continue until his return. It will continue. That's a promise. I mean, that's just that. Now, how do we treat this fallen world? How do we treat those? Well, as I said, they are not our enemies. They're Christ's enemies. And how did Christ treat his enemies? How did Christ, talking about bearing the cross, how did Christ treat the enemies who were crucifying him? Well, what did he say? I'm going to get you. No. Forgive them. And there's a sense in which we forgive, but we also preach. We also proclaim. We proclaim Christ and him crucified. That's what Paul did. Notice, it's a going forth of the word. Now, we're not like Paul because we don't have any divine revelation of what's going to happen to us at any point in time in our life. Paul does have that. That's correct. Paul knows he's going to go to Rome. He doesn't know what's going to happen when he gets to Rome, though, but he knows he's going to Rome. But we need to realize, because sometimes our life in this world, when things are going pretty good, we think, hey, this is our home. This is not our home. That's what I'm really trying to get you to understand. This is not our home. We're sojourners. To quote a famous line from a movie, we're on a mission from God. Some people laughed. But it's not our mission. It's his mission. Christ, him we proclaim. We don't proclaim the church. We don't proclaim Christianity. We don't say, guess what, this rule will be so much better if you listen to what we say. It's not the kingdom of the church we're trying to establish. Christ has established his own kingdom. And he is doing it through our suffering. Again, Romans 8, we are heirs of God, fellow heirs with Christ. We will be glorified with him. Notice that's future. We will be glorified with him, provided we suffer with him. Your life until the Lord returns is a life of suffering. Notice I didn't say your life until the resurrection. Because my hope is, I hope your hope is that he returns before I die. Because what are we told? When he returns, the dead in him, those who have suffered, will be resurrected to a glorious life. And the rest of us will be changed at the twinkling of an eye. Changed from what? If we've already attained glory and great things and the world's great, why would we be changed? Christ is going to remake this world in a new way. But remember in Paul at the end of his life, he says, I don't know what's better for me. To live is Christ, to die is gain. Well, now, to live is Christ, it's to live is suffer. To die is resurrection. That's what he means. That's why he says, I don't know which one I would choose. He says, the death is better for me, but for me to remain and work is better for you, because I serve. When you serve, you're going to suffer. brothers and sisters, there is a plot against Christ and his church. But that plot not only has been discovered, it was foreseen. It was providentially controlled. And that plot has not really been averted. The plot, Paul's plot was averted. The plot of the world against us has not been averted. It has not been averted. Because, remember I said this about Saul of Tarsus? That's how I called him. See, Saul of Tarsus was a plotter. Brothers and sisters, we all are, by birth, plotters. It takes the grace of God for the anathema that we call upon ourselves. It takes the grace of God to change that. And we need to understand that. See, we read the Bible, we look at the world, we say, well, these are the bad people. Every time you say that, you should look in the mirror. That's why we confess our sin each time we come here, to remind ourselves of who we are, but of who Christ is. But what does Jesus say on the cross? Father, forgive them. He can only forgive them because he paid their sin and obeyed for them. By the way, he wasn't the only one who said, forgive them. Who else said, forgive them? The first Christian martyr, isn't it?
Stephen.
We can actually do that. But we can only do that as he enables us. Let's go do that in prayer.